more to-dos, less time, and an infinite number of tools to keep track of. Sometimes doing business has never felt harder, but you don't need a miracle to hit your goals. You can just use HubSpot, because their all-in-one customer platform can make growing your business infinitely easier. Imagine this: high-quality leads, fast-closing deals, wildly happy customers, and more benchmark-breaking quarters. It's not a miracle. It's HubSpot. Visit HubSpot.com to get started today.
What's up, everybody, and welcome to episode 119 of the Talking Chop podcast. I am your host, Brad Roll, and it's been too long since I've had this person on the podcast. Good friend of mine, good friend of the program, Zach Dillard of Fox Sports South. What's up, man?
I'm sure all the Talking Chop listeners are chomping at the bit to listen to me ramble on for way too long, but I'm happy to be back and good to hear from you, bud.
Yeah, you and I talk all the time, but not in this particular format, and it's nice to have you. You know, lots of stuff to hit on. This is a very weird week. We can probably just start with what actually transpired. It was a 2-3 week, and if you said that, you probably would not have guessed that it was two wins sandwiched around three losses and a losing series against the Orioles over the weekend. But I guess, I mean, things would be more negative today if they had not come out with a victory on Sunday afternoon. But they finally managed to beat the Orioles at least once on the diamond, and as a result of that, still leading the East, still in pretty good shape. But what was your takeaway from this week that was sort of a pretty strange 2-3 performance?
I mean, you never want to give up games to sub-500 teams, but I do think the conversation around the Braves has something to do with the shifting expectations for this team. And I think if you go to, you know, my preseason predictions, your preseason predictions, most people's preseason predictions, where they're standing right now is pretty good. And
oh, yeah.
I know that this is a 2-3 stretch against some pretty poor teams from the AL East, but they're in the middle of a really long stretch against some really bad teams, and they're 7-4 in that stretch so far. They don't have some of their top pieces. Acuna, we're going to talk about, I'm sure, in a minute, hopefully coming off the DL here soon. Mike Foltynewicz hasn't been available. Mike Soroka. So I think you look at the 7-4 stretch over the last 11 games, just looking at the five-game span hasn't been that good for them, but overall they've played pretty well, and of course over the course of the season they're far outpacing anybody's expectations.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I can't remember who tweeted this, but somebody was talking about how crazy it's been from, I guess, Braves country, whatever that means, how high and low people have gotten this season. Like, people have already sort of forgotten how this is kind of a gravy season. No one expected this. Even the people that were as high on the team as possible were projecting, like, 82-80. Like, nobody really had, like, a 91 pace before the season started. So, I mean, they might cool off. They may not win the division. They may not make the playoffs. But anybody that said, like, anybody that could be actually disappointed with the way things are going right now probably is not being overly realistic, even if this week was kind of frustrating in a lot of ways. You mentioned Acuna. Before we'll hit on some more transactional stuff a little bit later, but since he's coming back, it looks like pretty soon. I guess Snicker said on Sunday afternoon after the game that he does not expect Acuna to be back on Monday. I guess he's going to spend Monday at least in Gwinnett. I don't know. I mean, I'm not even sure what I want to ask you other than the fact that he's obviously coming back soon. What are you expecting him to look like when he gets back? You think? I mean, they've been pretty careful with him, which is smart, I would say, obviously, with an asset like this, but what do you expect from him? We've only seen him for, 130 plate appearances, so we kind of don't know what he's going to be. But, all systems go, full speed ahead, however you want to say it, when he comes back, or is there like maybe a reintegration process?
Before I answer your question, I want to at least shout out to maybe the Braves tweet of the year from Bowman, given what Charlie Culberson has been doing and saying, has anybody ever heard of Wally Pipp? I thought that was in the pantheon of Braves tweets for this year.
On that note, real quick, I had a friend who is not a writer, but someone I went to high school with on I'm about to mention Facebook, so just brace yourself. That was in a long rant about how Acuna should not be guaranteed playing time when he came back, and I had to use the mute button. I just couldn't take it anymore. It was incredible.
Yeah, I mean, he's been out since May 28th, and since he's been out, they've been scoring 4.6 runs per game. They were averaging 4.8, with him in the lineup. That's not to say they haven't truly missed him and his productivity across the board, but I'm curious more of, first of all, you want to see him make sure he's healthy. From the video that I've seen, whether it's pregame warmups or from him and Gwinnett the other night, just some highlights, it looks like he's running pretty well. It looks like the knee is, you know, pretty much holding up just fine. I don't think we're going to see Ronald Acuña going out loafing anytime soon. He's a player that is kind of at max, you know, max effort all the time, 100%, if you will. So I think that he's going to probably struggle at the plate a little bit early on. I'm curious where, probably more than anything, my biggest question is where Snitker puts him in this lineup. They just had a decent series, anecdotally at least, with Ender and Ozzie at the top. It won't surprise me if they put Acuña back to really where he started the season, right there about like six, when he comes back into this lineup. But I think he'll be fine. It's more of just getting him back up to speed with the bat, because I think that they took – I don't think they're going to throw him out on the field if there's a single hint of a question about the knee. So I'm not as worried about his health as I am just like getting him back into the rhythm of everyday at-bats.
Yeah, I mean, with a guy at this kind of talent, like this kind of pedigree, as you mentioned, there's no reason at all to risk anything. I know the Braves are winning more than we thought they were going to. They're on this pace, and they, quote, need him, and they absolutely do need him to be the best team they can be, but that doesn't mean anything when you're talking about, like, he's got to be 100% or he's not going to play. I mean, I think they know that with the way they've treated it so far, but, just worth saying out loud, there's no reason to push him in any way if he's not 100% healthy. You almost baited me into a lineup discussion, which I'm going to say for a little bit later. We almost went there now, but
what I would be interested too is not only where he's in the lineup and how he looks when he's out there, but how many off days does Brian Snitker give him? Because we've seen in the past, even when players may be banged up or they may have taken, let's just say, a pitch off the wrist, they're out there the next day. Will they be a little bit more cautious in terms of playing time for Acuña, given what they have gotten out of Charlie Culberson? Does it, not to back up what your friend on Facebook is saying here, but do they kind of play off the fact that Charlie's played well to give Acuña, let's say, like every fourth day off for a month or two? I don't know. That really just remains to be seen, but do we see some more off days in between? And to his credit, or to the managerial staff and the coaching staff's credit, I think we've seen a little bit more of that now. Dansby got the day off today until he came in with a pinch hit home run. Ozzie got a day off. He was kind of slumping there for a little bit. He's really rebounded since then. So we've seen some off days mixed in a little bit. It wouldn't surprise me if they do the same for Acuña.
Yeah, I mean, I probably wouldn't endorse, one of every four, but if they want to be really careful, I definitely understand that. And I should say, I've poked plenty of fun at Charlie Culberson, who was an outwardly bad hitter for a long time before this year. But right now, 103 WRC plus, and we're in the middle of June, well, near the end of June. So shouts to Charlie Culberson for doing something that I did not envision he could do. He's been very, very good, weirdly.
He's been great, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he really has. Like, this, it's not like... it doesn't feel very fluky. I mean, truly, like, being able to talk to Charlie a little bit, he's a player that takes this very seriously. Like, rain delays, like, he's not in the he doesn't see himself as a player that's in there playing Mario Kart with the rest of the players and stuff. He's always working. He knows his place on this team. He knows his role. And I mean, you have to give it to him. Like, he had a nice postseason. He's come back. He's had a nice bounce back year for the Braves. He's been a nice piece for them. And they really when they needed him to be, he stepped up. He's a big reason why they really haven't seen the offense plummet in Acuña's absence.
Yeah, he's been better than I ever thought, and he's definitely been important to what the Braves have done this year. All right, let's pivot to somebody I definitely want to talk about for a minute here, and that's Dansby Swanson, who you mentioned hit a home run on Sunday, but it did have the day off. And I saw a lot of discussion about Dansby. Not that there isn't always kind of that kind of discussion about Dansby around the internet, but especially this weekend, people talking about what he actually is now that we've now seen a pretty good sample. Like, we're almost at 1,000 plate appearances in Dansby's career, and his numbers are not overly impressive at the plate. I think his defense has been really, really good this year, and that's something that you have to say, and it's very important at shortstop to get that kind of defense. So with that caveat out of the way, What do you make of him at the plate? I think obviously the home run is nice today, but even with that, now in the season, he is sitting with an 89 WRC plus and 256 plate appearances, about a half season worth of plate appearances for a guy, maybe a little bit less than that. But I mean, just sort of up and down, like historically he's been the same way, very streaky, high and low kind of guy. BABIP's just been the same way. But what do you think he actually is right now versus what he actually could be? And like how much noise is there still in what he actually has performed at the big league level?
I think there's plenty of noise. A couple things here. Number one, you mentioned his defense, 6 defensive runs saved. And it really does speak to, regardless of how you are performing at the plate, if you are a plus and maybe even a plus-plus defensive player at a premium up the middle position, you still provide plenty of value for a team. The same can be said for this team in center field. So he is clearly providing them value, and he's clearly been a much better player this year. That was one of the biggest problems last year for Dansby, is not just the fact that he couldn't hit. It was when he got out into the field, it seemed like there was a carryover effect and there were errors. He was one of the, you know, some of the most errors in the game last year at shortstop. That all has seemed to dissipate this year. So he's played a lot better defensively. You have to first start out there, especially with an up the middle position. But second of all, I think there's still noise in terms of his offense, because he's clearly a much better player than he was last year. There's been growth at the plate. I think he's clearly demonstrated you cannot pitch him inside. At the same time, there's a pretty clear hole in his swing right now, down and away. Teams are going to continue to throw him sliders, continue to pitch him away until he can either start laying off pitches, either start demonstrating that he can go out and go the other way with those pitches, whatever it may be. But currently right now, 17 of his 26 extra base hits are on the inner third or over the middle. So clearly you can't pitch inside. It happened again today on that home run. Pitcher made a mistake, goes inside, he sends it out into the left field seat. So I think he's a young player, still has a hole in his swing, but he's made strides in that department, enough so that I would say it's not, you don't have to give up on him by any means in terms of being a plus on the offensive end. I think we saw it earlier in the year. He's just not quite there yet.
Yeah, I mean, I actually just realized I don't have the person's name to ask the question, so forgive me to whoever asked it. But somebody asked basically if we could write off him as a star offensively. I'm comfortable pretty much doing that, I think. I'm not saying that he can't be a plus offensive player, but I think the ship has probably sailed with him being like a legitimate superstar offensively. When you factor in the defense, that's probably a little bit something different. Like right now, he's on pace for about 2.5 WAR, which is very, very, very okay for a player who's not been hitting at the top of his game right now. But what's his ceiling, you think, realistically, offensively? I think defensively, we've now kind of seen that he can be a plus player there. That's very valuable at shortstop. But I mean, when you try to sift through all the noise, what is like a high end outcome for what he could be at the plate?
It's a great question, especially because we've seen so many players in the league over the course of one off season or a couple off seasons change their swing. And old timers can be as, you know, negative about this as they want, but launch angle and all of this comes into play. We've seen so many players
exit velocity. Very important.
We've seen so many players reinvent themselves. And just to say for a 25-year-old that we know exactly what he is going to be is difficult for me, because we, you know, top of the head right now, Scooter Jeanette was like a 25% below league average hitter. And then all of a sudden he's one of the best hitters in baseball. I still can't explain it. He's having a monster year. I'm not saying that is sustainable for Jeanette, or that could be what Swanson becomes. They aren't even comparable. I'm just saying, like, so many players have reinvented themselves after struggles, after finding out what they're good at, that I think if, you know, pushed up against the wall, I think somewhere around, you know, a 10% above league average, you know, hovering above league average hitter with a plus defense, plus arm, plus glove, you know, maybe like a 3 WAR, 4 WAR player. And that's really good. I mean, it's not like that's a bust. It certainly may not be what people want with the hometown kid, former number one pick, came over in a heist of a trade. thinking they were going to get the next, you know, the next shortstop superstar. And I think that always comes into account here, is that we're living in a golden age of shortstops, and everybody wants Lindor and everybody wants Correa and Corey Seager. But I don't think Dansby is going to reach that level. But it's not to say that he can't be a really good shortstop for a long time at the major league level.
Yeah, with the way that he's defending now and being more consistent with that, not committing the errors, as you mentioned, and the mental mistakes that he kind of was, you know, committing last year, if this is his real defensive level now, I think all he has to be is a league average bat. And you're talking about a 3 to 4 win player, as you mentioned. So that's not as sexy as some of the guys that you mentioned. I think you know that, and everybody knows that. But I'm not writing him off. There's this segment of the Braves country, as you want to say, that is kind of just thinking this is what he is, and I'm not quite there yet. I think there's enough pedigree, enough talent there to think he can be probably only a slightly above average hitter, but that would be a great player when you're talking about if he could post like a 110 WRC plus, 105 WRC plus consistently with his defense at shortstop. That's a very, very good baseball player and someone who would be valuable moving forward.
Good. I mean, you did just mention it though, like. Coming into today, now he's at, you know, hitting 11% below league average. But coming into today, 85 weighted runs created plus, he was still a one more player. Yep. So
he's still on pace for like 2.5 wins now.
Even right, with the bat. Like the premium. If you play a premium position like this, I mean, you see it right there in center field. Not everybody is going to be Freddie Freeman in your lineup. Now, would it be nice? And would it be nice to be the Astros, where it seems like 1 through 9, they just completely rake? Absolutely. But it doesn't mean that I don't think it's holding them back by any means at this point, what Dansby is, you know, becoming and what he is growing into. But I still think we have a long way to go in his development, that simply writing him off as a bust or as somebody that, you know, the Braves can't rely on moving forward, that to me just doesn't make any sense.
Yep, I'm with you 100%, and it was definitely nice to see him hit that home run off the bench on Sunday. Transitioning to someone who we've seen a lot more of and that we know a lot more about, and that is Julio Teheran. I was in the building on Saturday when he allowed 4 runs before recording an out. Granted, it was sort of a perfect storm of the grand slam that went like 2 feet over the wall, so it probably wasn't as bad as that would indicate, but now sitting there with a 5.28 FIP on the year, 4.52 ERA, he's had some really good starts. He's had some really, really bad starts. His control's been bad this year. You know, one of the overarching questions is like, what is Julio Teheran? And it depends on the day, I will say. When he's throwing in the mid-90s, but the low 90s, he's a different pitcher when he's, you know, sitting 88, which does happen now occasionally. But I mean, I guess I'm asking you, like, I mean, it's impossible to answer, but what is he going to be now? Because I think this is we're sort of in a new stage with Julio. He was not very good last year. I think people were hoping he'd bounce back, and he's been worse. So, and to the point where he actually, at least according to Fangraphs, has been a sub-replacement level player. That's pretty brutal for a guy who's been your, quote, ace. He's never been that kind of pitcher, but your number one starter, your opening day starter the last few years. He's not going to be that anymore moving forward. We kind of know that. But is he someone that can bounce back and be a useful piece, or is he kind of just like a guy at this point that you probably want to look to move on from in the future?
Well, this is where I'm starting to question myself and my past, you know, statements on Julio Teheran and what I think of him. I always thought that if Julio Teheran, even if he struggles, he's on a team-friendly deal, and even if he becomes a mid-rotation to back end of the rotation guy, it still makes sense in terms of value what he can provide your rotation for what he was signed for. But I think this past week has really underscored the volatile nature of Teheran. I mean, 6 no-hit innings, 11 strikeouts, and then he turns around and he looks like a triple-A pitcher against the Baltimore Orioles.
I mean, it was very bad on Saturday, like very, very bad.
and I think that all – you know, my real curiosity here is how much patience does this front office show with Julio Teheran?
A guy, you know, who isn't their guy.
He isn't their guy. He has 1 year left on his deal after the season, and then he has a club option. At what point, you know, we talk about, and again, injuries have kind of undercut this a little bit, but when they are fully healthy at the moment, you could argue they have a bit of a log jam at the starting pitching spot. especially when you throw in Gohar and Colby Allard whenever they deem them ready. I think that Brandon McCarthy is the easy scapegoat because he's the rental veteran that is not, you know, is he ain't from around here. He's from the Dodgers, and he's clearly not been as effective as he was last year for Los Angeles. But McCarthy's been better than Teran this season. And even though, you know, he gave up two home runs today, clearly not the pitcher that he was, but he's still giving them a chance to win today, whereas with Julio against Baltimore, that was clearly not the case. I wonder if McCarthy truly is that pivot point in this rotation when they do decide to make a move, whether it's a trade or whether it's calling up the likes of Allard, or if at any point this front office tries to cut ties with Teran, whether it's this year, this offseason, whatever it may be. I think we clearly know, at least I would assume, that he's not going to be their opening day starter in 2019.
No, that ship has sailed, I think. Yeah.
But I wonder if he how long his leash is in this rotation. And, you know, we heard a lot of question marks about McCarthy when he was going through his struggles. He was even asked in a post-game session about, you know, does he worry about being moved out to the bullpen? I think my biggest question is on Teran, and what do they do if they actually do go out and make a trade, or they do bring up a prospect? It's really difficult in terms of performance and merit to say that Teran is the one that shouldn't lose that spot.
Yeah, I mean, it's really weird. And by the way, I mean, you mentioned the team-friendly deal. I'm guilty of this as well. You know, next year is $11.1 million, and that isn't necessarily looking to be a bargain, which is weird. Like, I've always thought of that deal as this great deal, and, you know, $11 million is not crazy for a starting pitcher that's even a solid fourth starter, but he hasn't been that this year. He's had moments of that, obviously, but the cumulative effect, like, you have to believe that he can be that for him to be, you know, quote, worth the $11 million. So it's not like it's not like he makes no money. There is some financial consideration there as well. And yeah, I mean, McCarthy's been better cumulatively than Teran, if you look at all the numbers, which is kind of a weird thing to say as well. So I don't know. I mean, your guess is as good as mine. I think we're just kind of talking out loud and spitballing about what this is going to be, because we're all kind of guessing. You outlined it perfectly when you talk about his last start before Saturday was just absolutely fantastic. And then Saturday, he looked like he was, you know, Williams Perez or someone of that nature. So,
well, I mean, and that's what it comes down to, right? Is like you see the highs of Julio Teran, and if that's what the front office believes he can still be, then clearly we're spinning our wheels here, and this conversation is going to go nowhere. But the cumulative effect here is, you know, this season alone, league and park adjusted FIP among pitchers with 80 or more innings, he's third worst in baseball. Since the start of the 2017 season, among qualified starters, he's still third worst in baseball behind only Ian Kennedy and John Lackey. So clearly he's been one of the worst everyday starting pitchers in baseball since the start of last season. The question would be, are the highs, are those single game starts or one or two or three game runs that he can go on, is it tantalizing enough to believe that he can still be that pitcher, or is just the ship sailing for the front office on Julio Teran? I'm not saying I know either way.
Right.
That's one of my biggest question marks with this roster, not only for the 2018 season, but moving forward, is the one pitcher that's locked in on a guaranteed deal, he might be the biggest question mark in that rotation.
Yeah, and that's one of those things that you and I mean, even you, who's there a lot and is around, we don't know that kind of information as much as the team's gonna, when it comes to how he feels physically, when it comes to his stuff on a regular basis, all those considerations, you know, what Anthopoulos actually thinks of him, all those questions are ones that we don't have the answers to. So, very interesting, and we'll definitely keep an eye on Julio. Real quickly, a couple of injuries to hit on in the rotation / bullpen right now. Soroka hit the DL this week, and Aroides Vizcaíno hit the DL finally, I guess, after about a weird spell where he was unavailable. Both those guys have now what they're describing as shoulder inflammation. Are you worried about either or both of these stints on the DL? I think we'd all say Vizcaíno's was kind of the weirder situation, but being that this is the second time that Soroka's hit the DL, and he's so young, has been so good when he's pitched, it's got to be a little bit of a worry spot.
Slightly concerning because it's a reoccurring injury, and this was a player that simply never got hurt throughout the minors. We saw the velocity really dip. He mentioned that when he was talking to the media about, you know, what the injury was and what they diagnosed. You know, the dip in velocity when he was even trying to reach back up there in Toronto certainly was a cause for concern. And he even admitted it's, I'm sure, a bit of a cause for alarm for a young pitcher that has never gone through anything. But I think where the question mark around Soroka comes in, that, you know, he worked so many, and he was a workhorse almost at an unprecedented rate in the modern game for a high school arm. 387 innings pitched since being drafted in 2015. Year after year, just was incredibly healthy, just ate up innings. And it was, you know, is that a red flag? I don't know. Certainly, Sports Illustrated, Tom Verducci, mentioned Soroka, and he actually led his piece off. He does this every year about minor league pitchers that have, you know, huge jumps in innings pitched, and Allard and Soroka pitched a bunch. He even mentioned Luis Gohara. We've now seen with Soroka and Gohara some injuries early this season. So I'm not overly worried about it. Soroka didn't sound like he was overly worried about it, but maybe they give him a little bit more time to bounce back. And I'll be honest, the Viz thing is a complete mystery. It's been handled in a really, really weird way. Just instead of like putting him on the DL, which they did today, he's just been like randomly unavailable even after not pitching for 4 or 5 days. It's been a really weird situation, but it was good to see Evan Phillips get the call up. You know, he's clearly been productive enough. He's been arguably their top reliever throughout the season in the minors. And you guys mentioned over at Talking Chop, from April 12th to June 19th, struck out 48 batters and an 0.85 ERA. So we went on a run there where I was even starting to question, okay, they're having some bullpen issues. Where's Evan Phillips? It's good to see Phillips finally get his shot.
Yeah, I mean, I've been hearing from Eric and the minor league guys, like, all right, it's time. Evan Phillips, for the last couple of weeks even. And this opens the door for it, but, you know, we'll see what he looks like when he gets there. The Vizcaino thing is just so bizarre. I mean, a couple of times where I will, you know, people that are, I think, are smart around the social media and blogosphere were kind of like, all right, that doesn't make any sense. Is Vizcaino unavailable? And then he ended up not being available. And a couple of days where you knew ahead of time he was unavailable, and it's like, why is he unavailable? He didn't pitch the last 2 days. And yeah, it's just a weird spot. And I guess I read some quotes from that Mark Bowman had today, and, you know, I guess it's kind of a collective shrug. Like, they kind of just hear from Viz, and if he's not right, they're not going to throw him out there, which I understand. But very interesting to see your closer type, if you still believe in closers, and clearly Snicker does. He's been using him in that role the entire season. You know, right now they still have two very good arms in Minter and Winkler. Minter had the, you know, I guess it wasn't a save spot today because of the home run by Dansby, but he's the one that closed the game on Sunday. And those guys are very good, but it does make you less deep because outside of the top guys in the bullpen, there are some less than stellar spots, at least recently. So we'll see what Evan Phillips looks like. Hopefully they trust him enough to throw him in some high leverage spots potentially because he has that kind of arm. But yeah, a little bit of a worry. I mean, Soroka, I'm not terrified, but it definitely raised my eyebrow. I know Anthopoulos has a little bit of a reputation for DL manipulation, but this does not feel like that. I think he actually has an issue. The first time, I kind of got a lot of eyebrow raises, like, is he actually hurt? Maybe not. But this time, like, you know, twice in this short of a time span, it's at least something you have to put your guard up about.
Well, I mean, the velocity dip in Toronto was the huge kind of red flag there that, like, I know I mentioned it. We were sitting around the office because that was the day game. It was like, whoa, like it was like a two strike pitch, and it was a fastball, and it'd be like 88, 89. And it was like, you know, that's just not Soroka. I mean, he's throwing like 93, 94 mile per hour sinkers. So I think the velocity dip clearly points to the fact this isn't, you know, DL manipulation by any means. He actually needed some time off. And, you know, I'm all for like DL manipulation too. I'm not even against that.
I definitely endorse the creativity that we've seen in the past from Anthopoulos and some spots. But
I mean, before they did it, I went on our show on Chopcast Live, and I was talking about with Fulton Evich, who had said he had some like tricep tightness, and I was like, well, just put him on the DL. They're in the middle of a run against, you know, sub 500 teams. He skips one start essentially.
Yep.
And then he's right back at it. You need him throughout the whole season If you have to do that with a pitcher, just be my guest, basically.
Well, I mean, as soon as they changed the rule to 10-day, you know, it was just jokes flying everywhere around the league about, you know, starting pitchers. It just makes your life so easy to skip one start and you just throw the phantom, you know, oblique strain up there. And it's like, all right, well, or, you know, shoulder, I guess, you know, because it's shoulder soreness or inflammation, it's like, that's sort of the obvious one, but it actually, when it comes true, it's kind of funny. But yeah, it's too easy to do, frankly. So if there's any issue at all, hangnail, blister, whatever, just throw on the DL. Why not? And, yeah, hopefully this is not what that is, but hopefully it's that kind of short, you know, absence from Soroka, because he's been a lot of fun and been very, very good when he's pitched. Before we get into some more controversial things, I want to just ask you, Freddie Freeman's the NL MVP by a pretty wide margin right now, isn't he?
Oh yeah,
I mean, I feel like a homer when I say that, and I know Max Scherzer is the other argument. I'm just the guy who says starting pitchers have to be like four times better than everybody else to actually win the MVP, in my opinion. So if you just, I guess if you put Scherzer in a different category, it's kind of like Freeman and everybody else.
I think that Scherzer clearly has a case here.
He's been unbelievable.
I think narrative plays in the minds of voters as well. And you have an out of nowhere team. Clearly he is their best player, anchoring the middle of a lineup for a resurgent offense. I think that plays in Freddie's favor as well. I'm not in that, you know, MVP or pitchers have their MVP for Cy Young. But if it's close, you know, I would like to see a position player get it. And you're right. They're pretty close. They're pretty neck and neck. I think the only other position players that I would throw into this mix, Arenado's been fantastic. Lorenzo Cain is, you know, kind of pulling a bit of a Freddie Freeman for a team there in the NL Central. He's been a great pickup for Milwaukee. But no, I mean, Freeman's outpacing Chipper's 99 MVP season. What's funny is I was looking at StatCast right before we came on. He's been unlucky this season.
Oh, yeah.
By quality of contact, strikeouts, and walks, StatCast has his expected weighted on base average 13 points higher than his actual one so far. So he's just been so good. And it's just going to continue. I think he's almost every single offensive category other than slugging. And that was last year's 2017 is above him. So he's just setting not only personal highs, but he's leading the league in pretty much every category you want to see. He's the MVP front runner.
Yeah, I mean, what's that stat? I feel like I should have written it down because I read it this week. Like, when was the last time he popped up on the infield? Isn't it like,
it's like, I haven't seen that one.
No, it's like, it's in some insane, he hasn't hit an infield pop-up in like 2 years or some outrageous stat like that. Yeah, I saw it making rounds on Twitter this week. Dang, I wish I had grabbed it. But yeah, it's, and it was from a real source too. It was like, you know, somebody that we trust. So yeah, I mean, just kind of just tells you that even when he doesn't, you know, do good things, he just doesn't, there are no issues with Freddie Freeman. He's just kind of an across-the-board monster. A guy who's exceeded any rational expectation of him, even, you know, but even by the time like 2016 rolled around, when he had his breakout, it was like, all right, we were talking about it. I think even on this podcast, like, all right, there's a possibility that's the best year of his career. You know, he had a 6-win season. He had a 152 WRC plus. He was incredible in 2016. And then he was better last year, and he's on pace to be better again this year. It's incredible how good he is.
He's in the prime of his prime, and
it's boring to talk about, which is why I'm like making a point to talk about it now with you, because it's like, all right, Freddie's really good again, awesome.
I mean, he's helped a little bit by, I would say, three or four of the top players in baseball that are right there with him playing in the American League,
and Bryce Harper doing weird things.
Bryce has had just such a weird season. He's in the middle of that slump, but. In terms of just hitting, and I think other players provide value in other ways that, I think Freddie's a good defender at third base, but it's difficult to.
Did you go third base just then?
Oh, I'm sorry, first base. Hey, he was pretty good at third base too. I'm sorry.
I was like, oh my gosh, is Zach about to make the argument for Freddie Freeman at third base again? It's time.
Yeah, put him back over there. No. So at first base, he's a pretty good defensive player, but it's hard to replicate what other players can do, whether it's at an up the middle position or even in the outfield. So, or at third base, like an Arenado. But just in terms of hitting, I mean, since the 2016 season, it's Mike Trout, Freddie Freeman, Joey Votto. I mean,
I was going to say,
He's on an extremely short list.
I was hoping you were going to get that because, like, I mean, we were talking about it. I have a couple of friends who are Braves fans that I went to the game with on Saturday that aren't, like, super big-time baseball fans. They just watch the Braves and root for the Braves. And I try to talk about Mike Trout and how good Mike Trout is, and they kind of just poo-poo it and do the very casual fan, like, what has he ever won kind of thing, which makes me crazy. But and talking about that, I was like, look, I mean, you could make the argument that Freddie Freeman is the second best hitter on the planet. Like, I would listen to that argument. Like, he doesn't bring value in the way that Trout does on the bases or necessarily defensively at the same level because it's first base and all that stuff. But pure hitter, you could tell me he's the second best hitter on the planet, I would not necessarily argue with you, which is crazy.
Yeah, I mean, the only other players that I'm looking at it right now that you could throw in that have been playing that whole time, Aaron Judge is in there, but he hasn't played as many games. The only other players that are right there are, like, Altuve and J.D. Martinez are right there in that mix as well. But, I mean, yeah, it's Votto, Freeman, Altuve, Trout. I mean, it is an extremely abbreviated list.
And, yeah, he's very good.
Yeah, when he's healthy, he's just I think he's the MVP in the National League until proven otherwise so far.
Absolutely. All right, one more thing before we get to some big picture stuff at the end, and that is that there was an interesting quote today from Brian Snicker about Ender Inciarte, who's now back in the leadoff spot, and looks like he's going to be staying there. I've talked about that a lot on the podcast, something that I do not endorse as a practice just because Ender, I don't think, is the kind of hitter that you want in the leadoff spot other than the fact that he's fast. But what did you make of that particular quote? And I'm going to read it for you right now. This is from Gabe Burns, passed this along on Twitter. And he says, Snicker says, I personally think we're at our best if Inciarte is leading off and doing what he's capable of doing. End quote. What is your reaction to that?
Ron Howard voice, they were not. Look,
agreed.
Ender's played. He's hit pretty well over the last 2 weeks. He's, you know, had a good series against the Orioles until today. But even so, even before today's 0-for-4 with one walk performance at the top, he was hitting 41% below league average at the leadoff spot. Like, at a certain point, this entire narrative just gets a bit tiring, and it's just like this nonstop allusion to the fact that the Braves have this leadoff savant that, despite all of that, his career best OBP would rank 55th in the majors right now. Like, it's in some ways it's unfair to the player because the Braves always talk about him as if he's going to, you know, save the day at the top of the lineup.
Well, even on the broadcast today, though, like, I'm not sure if you're, like, listening live today on Sunday, but, you know, you have Joe Simpson talking about how Ender, like, really sees himself as a leadoff hitter and the fact that he wants 100% to be a leadoff hitter and, like, he thinks that's his, like, spot that he needs to be in. And I understand from player perspective, you know, I don't fault the guy for wanting to be in the biggest spot. And if you're playing at the top of the lineup, you're going to get more opportunities. But in the same breath, because he thinks he is, does not mean that he is. If that makes sense, like, I'm not blaming him for that mindset, but just the whole, as you sort of allude to there, the whole narrative around the whole team and everybody talks about it that way. And I know, I guess Ender's very easy to like. I mean, I've heard good things about Ender as a guy. I had never talked to him, so I can't speak to that, but. It's just kind of overwhelming in the fact that he doesn't have to hit leadoff. He just doesn't. Like, I'm sorry. I mean, I wish he was. I mean, especially I think last year it was a crescendo because he had 200 hits, and 200 hits is this like mythical figure. I cannot tell you how many times in the last 4 months or 3 months since the season started, whatever it is, that someone who's an Ender fan has thrown back something on Twitter to me about how he had 200 hits last year. I understand he had 200 hits last year. You want to know what that means? He had a lot of plate appearances and doesn't walk a lot. That's what that means. I'm sorry.
Ender is a very well-liked teammate, a very good baseball player. I mean, seriously.
Yeah, he brings value in other ways.
He provides clear value, and he's on a team-friendly deal, probably going to be around for a good bit of time. And I think just right now he's one of the top five outfielders in terms of defensive metrics at the moment. He's providing all the value that you ever want out of him. And to those people that keep coming back to the 200 hit season, my reply would be, if he was doing that this year, I honestly wouldn't say that much.
Agreed.
Like, Ozzy hasn't been fantastic up there. Dansby hasn't, you know, capitalized and, you know, pushed his way to the top. The one player I'd really like to see get a shot.
Do it.
Would be Johan Camargo. And See, I know you're going to go Markakis.
Oh, you know I am. Absolutely.
But I actually really like what they've gotten out of Freeman and Markakis in the middle of the lineup.
Yeah,
I wouldn't mess with it. Camargo has pushed his way into the conversation. He has like a 360 OBP. He's well ahead of Ozzie and Ender in terms of getting on base.
He is walking an insane amount.
The plate discipline. Thank you. The plate discipline has been fantastic. I mean, he really does look like he's in control up there. And Camargo's the guy that I would give a shot. But if Ender was doing exactly what he was doing last year, like a 351 OBP, I wouldn't say a thing. I really wouldn't. Like at this point, it wouldn't be worth the argument. But they haven't gotten very good production out of that spot, whether it's been Ender or Ozzie. So, I mean, it was a nice series for them, but I don't know how sustainable it is when you look at the cumulative effect of hitting one of your two or three least productive everyday players this season, giving him the most plate appearances. It's not a very good recipe for success. I'm not saying that he can't heat up in the summer and get going, but I feel like about 18 times this season, I've heard he's heating up and in the NBA Jam voice, and he wasn't.
He was not.
So
heating. Yes,
I don't know. I don't like making this like a negative about Ender. It's more of I would like to see Ender do it for like get to league average hitting first, and then we can have a conversation.
Well, that's the thing about Inciarte that drives me crazy is that, you know, you mentioned last year, and I agree with you. I would not be nearly as vocal as I have been about him hitting leadoff if he had done what he did last year. But by the way, even last year, he had a dead at 100 WRC plus for the season. He was not this spectacular hitter last year.
Right. I mean, the slugging wasn't exactly there.
No, he has no power, and that matters less than the leadoff spot, which I understand, again, and this is why I'm saying I would have left it alone if he's doing the same thing he did last year because, you know, leadoff, you don't necessarily need power, and that's part of the recipe for WRC+. I understand that, but a 350 on base percentage is not anything crazy to write home about. It's just not. Like, it's fine. Right. It's very good. But
that's what I said earlier. It would rank 55th in baseball at the moment, but if you want to say that, okay, that 351 OBP at the top is better than anyone else has provided so far, plus he's on pace for 25, 30, 35 steals. We like him at the top. He's a leader. You know, he's kind of a spark plug for our team. You can make all of those arguments if the numbers were backing you up there. But we're clearly at a fairly significant sample size for the season, and we haven't reached that point yet. So even if you want to say he's heating up, in the month of June right now, he's hovering around 300 OBP in a 325 slugging. So it's one of those things where, like, at a certain point, for my own sake, I'm always going to go off of merit. I'm not going to go off of, okay, but he could do this, which is essentially what Snicker said today, was I think when he's at his best, he's going to do this. Well, when I think Julio Teheran is at his best, he could be a middle of the rotation, you know, number two type starter. But Julio Teheran hasn't been in his best for the majority of the season, so I don't know what that means.
Yeah, I mean, quickly, a couple things, and I want to get back to Inciarte for a second. For Ender's career, which is mostly the Braves at this point, he has a 74 WRC plus against left-handed pitching. So
yeah, you can't hit him against left.
Right,
the top.
That is my thing.
That's like a non-starter.
If they now, at this point, said, even with this year, if Snick came out and said, all right, we're going to hit Ender against in the leadoff spot against right-handed starters only, I would be like, okay, that's fine. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily think that's the greatest thing in the world, but I would be quiet about it. But him hitting leadoff against a lefty is a bad decision objectively, and even last year, it was a bad decision objectively. This year, he has a 51 WRC plus against left-handed pitching. That's 49% worse than league average. Like, that's really, really bad. He cannot hit left-handed pitching. So, I mean, I know you're nitpicking for this year, but, like, that's a career sample of 74. Like, that's a bad hitter against left-handed pitching. So, again, it's not meant to single out Ender and, like, pile on. I've been quick to defend him from people sometimes about – I do think there's a ton of value in his defense. His base running is good. You know, all that stuff. But just as a pure hitter, that stuff matters. And the other thing that I've been thrown back on my face this year that's actually valid is that there isn't a perfect option. And I'm the first person to say there's not a perfect option on this team right now. Ozzy, you know, when Ozzy was slugging 570 early in the season, it didn't necessarily matter so much. But now that he's cooled off to a more reasonable pace, he's not getting on base. It hasn't been all season long. Doesn't fit perfectly there right now with the way that he's attacking the game.
Well, Camargo, time out.
Go ahead.
Because if we're going to do the Ender's heating up argument, then Ozzy's
heating up.
Had,
yeah.
I mean, Ozzy just had 9 hits in the series.
Yeah, he is heating up.
I don't like the heating up argument.
Right. That's why I didn't do it.
but if we're gonna play those cards, Ozzy is also heating up on a parallel path.
Well, here's my thing with that is, even when you point out that Ozzy's not been getting on base all season long, which I would be the first to say, there's still more value in that guy getting more plate appearances because he's still even after the slump, he was like still slugging like 490 for the year. Like he's even after the slump was still a plus offensive player for the season. So it's all about value. Like it's, you know, you only lead off the game once is kind of what I would say. Like you want your best hitters getting more plate appearances. It's a new school versus old school argument, I guess. But I want my best players batting more than my worst players. That's kind of what it comes down to.
Well, and you sent me, and we can get off of this topic. And I know it's kind of a hot button issue for everybody.
It is.
But I mean, you sent me the list and like the types of players that are getting leadoff plate appearances for their teams now. I mean, the Red Sox themselves are throwing Mookie Betts and Andrew Benintendi, and you know
it's as simple as getting your best player at the plate. It's not hard.
The Mets are putting Brandon Nimmo in there, and he's hitting really well this season. You can go down the list. Like a lot of teams are throwing their best hitters. Francisco Lindor is leading off. Charlie Blackmon for the Rockies leads off. I mean, I don't know how you can't look across baseball, you know, even seeing like the World Series MVP and George Springer, he leads off. Like so many teams out there are putting really good, they're like best hitters out there, and it's not the time to be stuck into like fast guy leads off, you know.
And middle infielder hits second. That's the other
well, Ozzy has kind of turned that on its head, but.
Well, no, yeah, but my point on there would be the day that Ozzy had the day off and they hit who hit second? That was a comical one. I can't remember who hit second the other day. Anyway, yeah, it was a challenge. Was it Culberson? Maybe it was Culberson in second. Somebody hit second when Ozzy was off, and I was like, oh yeah, that tells you all you need to know about the way they treat second. But yeah, I'll be the first person to say there's not a perfect option. My option would be Markakis, but I totally understand what you're saying about not shaking that up. I would only point out that since the 32-game barrage at the beginning, Markakis has kind of been what he's always been. He has a 774 OPS since that point, which is a fine to pretty good player. But the guy that we saw the first 32 games is not a real person. So with that caveat, I would be willing to do it, but I do understand that because you had success and because, by the way, you still don't have a critical anybody else that's necessarily better at hitting behind Freeman than Markakis has been with all of his doubles and stuff. So I totally get leaving him there for now. I think coming into the year, I was arguing about that. So that's not a new argument. I think Markakis' best asset is his on-base ability. And it's always been that way. It's still that way, even with the sort of inflated numbers from this year, from the beginning of the year. But yeah, it's an argument we're going to continue to have for a long time. And I really hope that Ender makes me look silly and just hits like 400 for a month and a half. That'd be fun. But I don't necessarily see that as a likely outcome.
Yeah, and for Markakis, I mean, I think this guy's gonna be an all-star, and again,
oh, he should be.
The crazy thing about Markakis, and not to go off on another soapbox here,
do it,
but there is a bit of revisionist history being played this season with Markakis, and I don't think it's
as if he's been this guy the whole time, Zach. He's been this 900 OPS guy,
right? And I don't want to sound like disingenuous. Like I did not expect him to do this. And he has clearly proven me wrong. Like he has been so good this season. And I think that you can say both things. You can say that, you know, the offense was declining. He wasn't near this player the last 2 years. And this season he has clearly performed, you know, fantastic. I mean, he's an all-star in my opinion. Like I don't think that like this like gotcha effect of like, ha, we told you that Markakis has been fantastic all along. Did I among other people, including yourself, like underrate, you know, kind of the everyday consistency? I'm sure I do. Like, sure. I'm sure I get lost in the numbers sometimes and sometimes underrate certain things. And, you know, Chipper Jones was saying the other day about, like, you know, it's not easy to, you know, I think he tweeted, like, it's not easy to get 2,000 hits, and it clearly shows, like, the professional hitter that he is.
And the durability, can, too.
Like, yeah, the durability.
Like, every day. I mean, he basically has one injury in more than a decade.
I mean, like, teammates love this guy. And when you just get lost in the numbers, like, you lose track of that, and you do lose sight of that. It honestly has been refreshing to see a player that, I mean, 2,000-plus hits. I mean, only Juan Pierre has more hits without an all-star appearance. I think it is. It's a really cool story to watch, you know, a player like that on his way to his first All-Star appearance, and, you know, prove people wrong, and it probably earn a nice final contract to, you know, end out his career if that's what he chooses to do. Who knows with Nick Markakis? But you know, it's been a nice story, and you don't have to play like, I don't know, like demonizing people that had legitimate criticisms in the past. And just because those criticisms no longer apply to this season doesn't make the past criticisms invalid. It's been a really weird conversation, and I know you've been trapped in it.
Oh, but, yeah, the whole way. And, I mean, it's
and I love all of the Twitter sphere. I love all of you.
It's fun. I mean,
it's been an interesting and really a fascinating season from that perspective. Watching him bounce back.
Yeah, as long as it's lighthearted, I totally get it all. And just for the record, this is currently the second best season of his career, and by far his best season since 2012 so far. Like, it's not even close. Like, his best season from a WRC plus perspective with the Braves was his first year, which is 106. This year's 136 coming in today, and after two doubles, it's now 138. So, yeah, he's above his head a little bit with the way he's been, and the last two seasons were not necessarily great, but yeah, I mean, there's no question he's an all-star this year. I would say nothing else of that. When you're evaluating all-star appearances, it's based on what you do in the first half of the season, and he's been awesome. And the 32-game barrage at the beginning of the year matters. It counts. It happened. He provided a ton of value, and it's not like he's cratered. He's still been just fine since then. He's just been more like his old self. It's not like that's a bad player either. Like,
yeah, two more doubles today.
And yeah, he was good again today.
Keeps going.
Like, and by the way, he's playing better defense than he has in a while. Like, he's basically been a neutral defender, according to FanGraphs and a lot of the metrics, and that's something that he could not say the last few years. So, a very nice bounce-back year, and I'm hoping that it won't result in some weird contract in Atlanta this year, but he's going to get paid somewhere. I mean, and he should. I mean, because even if it's just what we've seen this year, even if he's just kind of the guy he's been for the rest of this season, he's going to end up with a full year-long sample that's better than anything he's put on paper in a long time. And that's cool. So, shout out to Nick Markakis. Last thing before I let you get out of here, I have to ask you about Brian Snicker, because it's a topic that we cover a lot on the podcast. I am not a huge fan of him tactically, but I think because you're in the locker room, and most people that I have on the podcast are not in the locker room on a regular basis, I know Scott and Eric, we all try to sort of couch it with the fact that everybody seems to love Brian Snicker, and that does matter. But because you're around the team more often, maybe you can speak to it a little bit even more than I can. But, like, what's the balance like? And we sit in your opinion. What should the balance be like between evaluating a manager by his tactics, in which I think most people would acknowledge he's not the greatest tactical manager in the world? When you balance that with what he does in the locker room, what's that mix like for you?
Well, what the mix is like for me and what it's like for the front office and the players are probably going to be two very different things. But I think at the end of the day that you're going to be judged on your body of work. And I would say that as this roster has improved, clearly you could see in the standings that the results have improved as well. And Snicker deserves more credit than I give him for that. I think more credit than a lot of people give him for that. And I'm with you. I don't think that he's one of the, you know, I question tactics all the time. And that, I think that just comes as part of, you know, our jobs on this side of the fence. But this is clearly a team that is, you know, punching above its preseason projected weight. And I think that he deserves some credit for that. There's also some times that I question things. and we just talked about this, but I question things that it comes out later that weren't necessarily in his power. The Vizcaíno thing is a perfect example.
Yep.
Of things that I'm like, why did Viz not pitch there after throwing for 5 days?
I've definitely done that before this season.
And then it comes out later that, well, he wasn't even available, so the manager is not going to throw an injured pitcher. And clearly, you know, I was wrong in that sense for questioning, you know, that line of strategy. So we don't have all the information on it. I do think there are certain things, and we just went on a whole diatribe about Ender, that I would change. But if this team stays in the hunt and it stays in contention and the players are clearly buying into his message and what he's saying and they listen to him, I really don't have much to add to the conversation at the moment. I do think it that when you are contending and you are going for a playoff spot, that getting, you know, trying to win, and this sounds very elementary, but trying to win on any given night and managing as such takes on a bit of a higher priority. So it'll be interesting to see how that develops over the course of the season. It'll be interesting to see how the relationship between the front office and the managerial staff. I think we've seen a couple things where they go in different directions so far this season.
Well, and it's worth noting that Anthopoulos did not hire Brian Snicker. He inherited Brian Snicker, which is interesting.
That's true. I will say for Snit, he has a really good coaching staff around him. I really do believe that Weiss and Washington and Eric Jones
Senior, Ron Washington, the legend.
they really have added a nice. It's a coaching staff from what I've seen is really beloved by the players. I mean, the infielders and anyone that works with Wash really loves him. I think you clearly see the work that Eric Jones Senior came in. Put in with the base running, and Walt Weiss has been a nice steadying presence, I think, too, and somebody that Snitker, I think, trusts on his bench. So this is a really long answer in saying that, like, this team is ahead of where they are at the moment. I'm not going to be overly critical of individual decisions when it's panned out over the long run, but if as we get closer to the playoffs, there's going to be more scrutiny on every single managerial decision, and you get into the playoffs and it's even more so. That's not exclusive to Brian Snitker. That's true of every single MLB manager out there. So as this all evolves, I'm sure we'll talk about this more, but I think he's done a fine job thus far in terms of guys, you know, buying in, and clearly you see what they're able to do in late game situations. It's not like they ever just mail in a game. They don't cash it out. I think there's something to be said for that too.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to get your perspective on that, just because, like I said, you're around the team more than most. So I think you have that little bit of behind the curtain that people like myself don't necessarily get. So thanks for that. One last quick thing that I forgot to mention before. I wanted to ask you if you have a favorite potential trade target or two, because we got a ton of questions in the mailbag that we probably won't get to most of, but that's one that I wanted to at least pass along and let you answer. Like, I'm not necessarily asking you to predict what's going to happen, but if you had a guy or two that you'd be particularly looking for the Braves to maybe go after, who would that be?
Okay, a bit of a speed round. I'm not sure if they are going to go out and get a young, controllable starter. That's really good, but I would like to see that. I'm not sure where they're at there. Third base, I don't think, is near as much of a need as people say it is, because Camargo's been really good. In my opinion, Camargo's been better than a guy like Moustakas this year. I thought that the Adrian Beltre talk was interesting, but I don't know what exactly that would cost.
By the way, that's the question with everything, is what does it cost? Everything. Every question we're going to talk about, what does it cost?
Well, I mean, so John Morosi threw this out there.
Yep,
I saw it. About Cole Hamels and Adrian Beltre. And, like, honestly, I wouldn't be totally against that. Hamels hasn't been very good this season, but it's extremely expensive, and I don't know what the Braves would actually have to give up other than like a mid-tier prospect.
Well, and the whole thing is
the Rangers have to pay money too.
Well, and there's the reporting from Bowman that says basically the ownership group is not exactly eager to take on big money, and that's big money. So,
yeah, I mean, the Rangers would have to help pay for that, or else they're going to give those two players for free, because I don't think either one of them would be worth a good prospect to even make it worth their time. So I'm not necessarily all in on that. But if they do make changes to the bullpen, I think it would be very easy there's a ton of teams that are out of contention with a bunch of really good relievers. I think that's the easiest way to go. I think one of the players we just saw from Baltimore, I really like Michael Givens. I know that Brad Brock and Zach Britton get the headlines, but Givens, 28-year-old righty, 3 years of arbitration left after this season. And here are his four seasons so far. 0.9 war, 1.2 war, 1.2 war. He's in the middle of a one war season already with a 2.76 FIP. So I really like Michael Givens, a really good right-hander for them. And year after year, he's been just extremely solid. And he's somebody that not only – it's not like the rental like the Nationals went and got with Kelvin Herrera. This is somebody that you can have in your bullpen for years to come as a nice piece. The only other one I would throw out there, another bad team, a ton of relievers. It was hard to kind of land on one, but the Padres, we saw them plenty over the past month or so. But I really like Kirby Yates for the Padres. You look at his Statcast numbers, he's way above the curve. Picked up a splitter this year. Fangraphs recently mentioned that he had the biggest jump in his ground ball rate, so that splitter's really come into handy. But high strikeout, high whiff rate, and Kirby Yates is a right-hander to kind of keep your eye on. 2 years of arbitration left for him too. So I like getting controllable guys. I'm not all in on finding a rental unless it's a cheap rental for this team, because I don't think it necessarily makes sense of where they're at.
It's all philosophical, but I am not in the place of, I mean, I don't think anybody responsible is going to say go all in on this team, but I think I'm even further away from that. Like, I would be pretty reticent to go after a rental, provided, I mean, there's certainly a level of prospect where I'd be willing to do it, but like, there's always the hypotheticals of like what it would take to get Machado or something like that. And it's like, I don't think that the timeline lines up there. I just don't see the Braves paying big in prospect for someone who is almost certainly a rental. That's a tough one in a lot of
ways. Yeah, but I mean, apparently they really like the prospects from the Royals, but I didn't think the Nationals paid an arm and a leg for Herrera.
Well, they did. So, that's the kind of deal that makes sense. Yeah.
So a rental like that makes sense to me. I think something that does get lost when you're on our side of the fence is that there is something to be said for owing it to your veterans, whether it's McCarthy or, you know, Nick Markakis or whoever. You owe it to them to, when you have that opportunity, you don't know if you'll have that opportunity again. Yeah. So you do want to, you know, every time you have that chance, you want to maximize that chance.
Flags fly forever, Zach, as they say.
So I'm with you. You don't overpay. I don't think you go all in unless it's a controllable player past this season. But I think there's clearly a relief market that will benefit Atlanta. It would probably surprise me at this point, would be the best way to describe it, if they did not make at least an addition on that side of things, because there's just so many bad teams with really good bullpen arms.
Yeah, and that's a spot where the Braves could use an upgrade. I mean, obviously they have some really good guys back end of the bullpen, but the other guys are not necessarily going to blow you away. I mean, it's been a decent collective effort, I will say, from the bullpen, but it could certainly be improved, and that's a cheaper spot. It's always going to be cheaper to go get a middle reliever than it is going to be to get a full-time starting third baseman or a cost-controlled starting pitcher. That's just the name of the game when it comes to using prospects and all that fun stuff. So, yeah, that seems like a pretty reasonable outcome. And that's also a way to show the fan base, if they care about that, which they might a little bit, that they're trying to win this year. Maybe a little bit. I'm not sure that matters is like the reason why they would do it. But I think there's something to saying, look, guys, we're trying to go make the playoffs, and we're gonna do it by adding this guy.
I have news for the fan base. They are trying to win.
Oh, I know they are. But you know what I mean? Because it was such a quiet offseason. Like, they really didn't do anything. I mean, aside from the weird money trade with the Dodgers that ended up with McCarthy and Kemp and all that fun stuff, they didn't do anything.
Yeah, they went and traded away an MVP candidate, Matt Kemp. How about that?
Yeah, how about Matt Kemp?
How about Kemp? No. It's good for him. But that move made sense. And anybody that's been around Anthopoulos knows that behind the kind of – he's a like kind of good guy, you know, nature. I think he is extremely competitive. And yeah, I don't think that he's just going to mail in a season because he thinks, well, in 2019, that's where it's going to be. I'm not saying he's going to cash out on all the prospects, but I do think he has a bit of a – he said this a couple times, and I know you need to go.
No, you're good.
He's gotten more comfortable. One reason he didn't come in guns blazing, or two reasons. Number one, he didn't feel like he needed to put a stamp on this franchise. at all. He looks at himself, it was a really interesting quote, as more like a steward of a franchise. It's not about putting his stamp on it, but getting the franchise in a better state. But also, he didn't know who the prospects were. So he didn't want to go and make a trade on a guy that he didn't really have any familiarity with. He didn't want to go trade in Austin Riley this offseason just because they needed something at the major league level. So I think he's gotten there. He mentioned this in our booth the other day that he feels a lot more comfortable with the prospects they have, what he has to play with. So I think he can get a little bit more aggressive now that given where the team is and given that he has a better understanding of what he has. So and he is a competitive person. So I don't think they're just going to just sit on their hands through the July 31st deadline. And now that the market's set, especially for relievers, I think that's probably the easiest answer is where they go, at least where they go first.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. I think we'll have plenty of discussions about what they actually end up doing. If something is going to happen, I would bet as well. So within the next month, we'll have more to talk about. But thank you, Zach, for joining me on the pod. The Braves have a pretty interesting week coming up, and without previewing that too in depth, they do have Cincinnati for three and then the Cardinals for three. By the way, the Reds have won seven in a row, so break up the Reds starting Monday.
Yeah, NL Central better watch out.
They're still 32-45, so probably not, but alas. Well, thank you. Please plug anything you want, Zach. I know you are a television personality and such, so please get anything else that you want there, that you want out there, share it with people.
Well, that was a description television that I...
Television personality.
No. We do have Chopcast Live. Everybody can find that, on Facebook Live, SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher Radio. So Corey McCartney and myself do that. We also would encourage people to follow at Fox Sports Braves on the Twitter sphere. Plenty of highlights and stuff going on there. We have a ton of stuff all the time. So any Braves fans that are looking for anything else to follow, that's where you can find us on that addictive social media machine.
Also, if you're really interested in the Charlotte Hornets, Memphis Grizzlies, who else we got? Nashville Predators, Carolina Hurricanes, that one? You have all these teams you have to cover. I don't envy you sometimes, but you do a great job, my friend, so thank you.
Yeah, we have all those teams. We're like, you're one of the few people in the world outside of our office that knows that that we actually cover all those teams all here from Atlanta. So that's always a curveball for people that are like, wait, what?
Well, you and I talk often offline, and I'll be asking you something, and you're like, no, I have to cover the Hornets tonight. It's like, oh yeah, you cover the Hornets. That's right, I forgot.
Yeah, shout out to Mitch Kupchak and the crew up there now.
Trust me, I've been fighting the temptation to pivot into Hawks talk for about the last 15 minutes, so I'm going to keep fighting it, but thank you, sir, for joining me.
All right, me and Trey Young are out. We'll see you.
As for everybody else, please subscribe to the podcast, Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, wherever you like to listen to podcasts. We should be there, and we'll see you guys next week.